Spiritual Disciplines, the ninth talk in a series entitled Being a Spiritual Person, was presented by Ron Julian on November 21, 2006 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in our next to last session on being a spiritual person. Tonight I want to talk about the concept of spiritual disciplines. And this is going to be a little different talk than the others that I've done, because basically up till this point I've been trying to argue for something, trying to paint a picture of what I think this stuff is about in the Bible, and tonight it's more arguing against something. I'm going to take on a perspective that I think is not quite getting it right, and in order to do that, this is just going to be a more technical kind of discussion than some of the discussions have been as well. And I also have too many notes. I know already that I have too many pages here for the time we have, so I better get started. So what are we talking about when we're talking about spiritual disciplines? I think a good analogy would be, think about what you're doing when you go to the gym to work out. So you get on an exercise machine and you work out for half an hour. Why are you doing it? What are you there for? Are you doing it because you have a great passion for treadmills, you really like treadmills, and you every time you see a treadmill, you want to get on one? Probably not. The reason you do it is because, although the activity itself is not really what you're there for, you know that doing that activity is going to lead to results that you're looking for. Well, likewise, we could stretch this analogy, but I think spiritual disciplines, the sort of thing I want to talk about tonight, are religious activities that I take on in order to produce spiritual growth. So the idea is that it's not so much that I'm doing this thing for the sake of the thing itself, but I'm doing it because it will get me results. So let me make this clear. Suppose that I commit a great sin and I pray to God. I confess my sin, I acknowledge my need for forgiveness, I ask God to help me so that I can overcome my sinfulness. Is that a spiritual discipline? Well, I would say no. It is, because the prayer itself is the point of what I'm doing. My intention is to pray. I sinned and I want to confess my sin to God and ask for His help. I'm going to Him because I recognize that this prayer is a good thing to do. Will it have results? Will it result in spiritual maturity in my life? It might. But that's not the reason I'm doing it, because it's an exercise like working out to say, well, I'm going to do this and it will make me better. I'm doing it because I want to confess to God that I committed a sin. So that's not a spiritual discipline in the sense that I'm talking about. But if someone tells me that if I get up at 6 o'clock every morning and pray, and I will have a huge increase in my spiritual life if I do that, then that's a spiritual discipline in the sense that I'm talking about. It's something that I take on as an exercise, as a discipline that is going to get me spiritual results. Now, lest you think that I'm setting up a straw man in doing that, you need to know that I have kind of a target. I decided I'm not going to name names tonight, but I have a target. There are authors, there's a movement in the Christian world that is very much emphasizing the idea of the spiritual disciplines. And one of the most influential and popular of the people in that movement would argue like this. He would say that Jesus has offered us rest for our souls, but few Christians actually experience this rest that He has offered. We don't experience the life that Jesus promised because we don't follow Jesus in the lifestyle that He lived. a moment of panic as I see blank pages here. Oh, good. The real one is in there, too. Okay, sorry. We don't experience the life that Jesus promised because we don't follow in the lifestyle that he lived. And how did he live? He fasted. He went out alone in the wilderness. He prayed. He lived without many material possessions, and so on. And it is because he practiced these disciplines, they argue, that he lived the sinless life that he did. And this particular author actually does argue that Jesus' sinlessness is due to his practicing of the disciplines. And we will only experience the same sort of victory if we practice the same religious disciplines that he did. He did not expect us to be able to follow his teaching successfully unless we practice the spiritual disciplines. The disciplines are like the training that a great athlete undergoes. You don't step up to the plate expecting to be able to hit a home run if you haven't been doing a lot of batting practice. So likewise, we can't expect to live victorious, godly, and fulfilling lives if we don't train our bodies in righteousness by practicing the spiritual disciplines. So victory over sin and fulfillment in life can be ours, but only if we follow the example of Jesus and fast, meditate, live simply, seek solitude, and so on. Okay, so it's that sort of perspective that I want to talk about tonight. Clearly, this is a big claim. It's very popular, as I understand it, in the church today. I see this author and other authors who are arguing the same sort of thing, and people who advocate this perspective are very popular. They speak a lot at churches. They write a lot of books, and this is a fairly influential movement in some ways. And if it's true, clearly it's very relevant to the topic of this class. This is how to be a spiritual person to a T. I mean, this is saying you can't even be a spiritual person unless you do these things. So what I wanted to talk about tonight is why it is that I don't share that perspective on the spiritual life. Now, I want to be clear, I don't have any objection to the idea of discipline. That is, it's appropriate for me at times to do things that I don't necessarily feel like doing, but it would be a good idea to do them, so I'm going to discipline myself to do them. And it might be a good idea for me to say, well, you know, I think it would be good for me to pray more often than I do, or to read the Bible more often than I do. I believe in prayer. I believe in Bible study. I believe in taking stock of my life and doing serious business with God. I mean, that's all good stuff. But the claim that's being made here is a stronger one than that. That this claim is basically that we're all missing it, that we're missing out on the feast of spirituality that we could be having if we would only be practicing these rigorous spiritual disciplines. And what I want to talk about is why I am not convinced by this perspective. And I would suggest that you, if you think about this, you might want to consider whether you want to be convinced by it as well. So I have a couple of problems with it I want to talk about. And like I say, this is a more technical discussion than some of the kinds of things that we've done up to this point. But first of all, one problem I have, this is actually one of the more minor problems, but it is it's still a significant problem. If you read the books by the authors who advocate this sort of perspective, they often defend their points by appealing to the experience of Christian mystics. It is those mystics in church history. After all, they're the contemplatives and the mystics. Those are the ones who have the most practical experience with spiritual discipline. So they certainly would be the ones who could be our guide and tell us the value of them and what we ought to do. Well, the problem is that how someone interprets their experience and what they think is working and not working and valuable and so on has a lot to do with how you look at the world and what you think is true. And part of my problem with Christian mysticism as a tradition is related to a little bit of historical background that I want to bring in real quickly here. And I don't know if this will be interesting to you, but it's part of my problem with this. From my perspective, unless I'm missing something, Christian and non-Christian mysticism alike have been greatly influenced by a philosophical movement called Neoplatonism. And we don't have to go a lot into Neoplatonism, but Neoplatonism has this picture that there is this ultimate reality in the universe that we could call God, but Neoplatonism called it the One. It is the unity. It is that which everything is from. And then the world as we know it is kind of fractured off the One, and it gets more and more diverse. And the way to achieve enlightenment and salvation is to make your way back into the One. So part of that perspective says, part of what Neoplatonism advocated was meditation as a means of reconnecting with the One. That you're going to take your mind and you're going to eliminate all thoughts. You don't hear that cell phone that's going off. You don't think about anything else. You empty your mind of all thoughts and hope to come into a union with the unknowable, because the One is unknowable, really. I can't think about it or understand it. I can only experience it. Many of the world's mystical traditions trace their origins back to Neoplatonism, as I would understand it. If you look at Eastern mysticism, you look at Christian mysticism, they all have their roots, as I understand it, in this Neoplatonist idea, which is why you have someone like a modern Christian mystic like Thomas Merton became a student of Eastern mysticism, and when he became a student of Eastern mysticism, he discovered, hey, we're doing the same stuff. I mean, this is the same thing. Because it is, I think. It is essentially the same way of looking at things. So there are these mystical writings like those of Pseudo-Dionysius or the Cloud of Unknowing, which are Christian works, but they are basically Neoplatonist works with a very thin little layer of Christianity put on the top of it, from my perspective. Now, one of the keys to this approach is it may be very fine and good to have a knowledge of God, just to think about, you know, God is good, God is saving me, God is merciful. Those are good things to think about, they would say. But a better thing to do is to not think about anything. If you want to come to understand God and know God, you need to empty your mind and just have an unexplainable, non-rational, mystical encounter with God, which is the Neoplatonist idea all over again. But so the teachings of many of those mystics was basically, don't sit and contemplate the goodness of God. Sit and empty your mind so that you can become in contact with God. Well, my problem with Neoplatonism at that point is that the Bible, there isn't even a whisper that I can find of anything like that in the Bible. All of the teaching in the Bible that has anything to do with the idea of meditation or anything like that is think about God. Remember how God saved you, Israel, from Egypt. Think about how God is doing this. Remember what Jesus did on the cross. Remember what God has promised in the future. So, in one sense, it's very appropriate for us to stop and take stock and to think and to contemplate and to think about. But what the Bible's always telling me to do is to think about something, to think about what is true so that my picture of reality is changing. So, the mystic approach, I mean, we have scientific evidence that there are changes in the brainwave patterns, you know, alpha waves and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure that something happens when you're doing this sort of emptying the mind kind of meditation. It may be a very fine thing that's happening, but there's no hint in the Bible that that thing that happens when I do that has anything to do with Christian spirituality. And Christian spirituality has a content. It is my will dealing with the truth of God and submitting to it. That's the picture of spirituality that the Bible has. So, when the modern spiritual discipline movement appeals to people like the Cloud of Unknowing, Meister Eckhart, St. John of the Cross, and people like that, I mean, they're worth reading and they have interesting things to say. But they are basically Christian Neoplatonists, and the question is if Neoplatonism is true or not. It's not a biblical idea. Is it compatible with the biblical teaching? Well, I'm not convinced that it is at this point, and it is certainly not what the Bible teaches. So when they appeal to those sources, I don't find myself really convinced. It's interesting that people had those experiences, but to say this is the way to God, when that's not the way the Bible describes as the way to God, I find myself unconvinced. So that's one of the little problems I have with the teaching on the spiritual disciplines. Probably a more fundamental problem that I have is the way that they deal with the Bible. I see the teaching on the spiritual disciplines, they look into the Bible and they see the Bible teaching spiritual disciplines. And when I look over their shoulder and look at the same passage that they're looking at, I don't see it. I don't think that's what the passage is getting at. So what I thought I would do is, years ago I talked about this before, but I think this is an interesting example. So one of the authors that I'm talking about, it seemed to me like this was a good example of the sort of problem that I have with a lot of the arguments that they make. So this author is making an argument that the spiritual disciplines are like an athlete training for competition. The disciplines are restrictions and difficulties that I take on myself off the field before the game, so that when I go to play the game, I will have trained my body in righteousness. So, for example, this author argues that the 40 days that Jesus spent in the wilderness were not a trial, they were spiritual preparation for Satan's temptation. If Jesus had not spent those 40 days fasting in the wilderness, then he wouldn't have been in top spiritual shape to fight off Satan's attacks. Fasting and solitude were the spiritual equivalent of a fighter sparring and skipping rope and punching a bag. This is the exercise you're doing, getting yourself ready to take on Satan. Why would we think that this is true? Well, the author appeals to Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 9:27, "I buffet my body and make it my slave." And this is the passage I wanted to talk about, the way that the author is dealing with this passage. "I buffet my body and make it my slave." Well, the author argues this is what Paul means by that. In the context, Paul has just described how he practices the discipline of frugality by refusing financial support from the Corinthians. So, Paul is deliberately choosing to live frugally, to not have money. He refused their money so that he could live in a near poverty state and thus have the spiritual discipline of frugality. So, Paul, when he describes buffeting his body to make it his slave, this is his way of describing disciplines like the discipline of frugality. I am deliberately going through this spiritual discipline of not having any money so that I can buffet my body and make it my slave, and I will be a better spiritual person when I'm called upon to do something spiritual down the line. So it's this buffeting of his body that makes Paul the spiritual success that he was. As this author puts it, "Paul's effectiveness is simply inconceivable without its extensive use of fasting, solitude, and prayer." Okay, now what I want to do, and in order to examine this appeal to this verse, "I buffet my body and make it my slave," I'm going to have to back up here and give you the context of 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and explain to you, I think, what it is that Paul's doing and the implications of what it is that he's saying. In this section of 1 Corinthians, Paul is addressing the issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols. We understand the problem that a Christian might have, this problem that the meat that you got at the meat market might have been used in temple ceremonies where the meat was offered to pagan idols. So what should I do as a Christian? Should I eat this meat because it was offered to a pagan idol? Some of the members of the church in Corinth consider themselves very sophisticated. They knew that Christians have the freedom to eat whatever they want. Paul agreed with them about this. Paul actually agreed, it doesn't matter whether the meat was sacrificed to idols. There's no idol. This is nothing. So just eat. Don't ask where the meat came from. It's not going to hurt you to eat this meat sacrificed to idols. But the people that he's dealing with in Corinth, like I say, they considered themselves very sophisticated, and they looked down on other Christians in the congregation who thought that it would be wrong to eat that meat. They said, you know, there's something, I don't know, this is wrong. We shouldn't be eating meat sacrificed to idols. Paul is concerned about the arrogance and the lack of concern for their fellow believers that is being shown by these sophisticated people. Have they ever considered that they might be seducing their fellow believers into violating their consciences? You know, they see you doing it, and they think it's wrong, and so they get this idea, well, maybe it doesn't matter whether, I mean, he doesn't seem to think that it's a problem, so maybe it's okay to violate your conscience and to do what's wrong. Maybe you shouldn't be so picky. You know, let's just go ahead and not worry about what's right and wrong. Paul is saying, if eating that meat causes their brother to stumble, then they should gladly limit their freedom out of love for their brother. So the issue in 1 Corinthians 9 is, how do I use my freedoms? I have the right to do various things, including I have the right to eat this meat sacrificed to idols. But I have to think about the impact that my decisions are having on other people. It's not just that I have the right, but if I exercise that right in a way that is destructive to someone else, then I'm not acting in love and I'm doing something wrong. Paul then turns to himself as a model. He looks at his own example, and he gives the example to the Corinthians. You know, you guys, I had the right to ask you to financially support me. I mean, you know, I am teaching you. It is appropriate and right. You should be supporting the people who teach you. You know, don't muzzle the ox while he's threshing and all of that kind of stuff that Paul goes into. But I didn't do it, he says. I didn't take a dime from you guys. I worked while I was there in Corinth, and I supported myself. And I didn't take money from you. Why did I do that? I did it for your sake. And I think the idea is that if Paul had taken money from them, they were a very contentious group. There were all kinds of problems going on there. And even now, as he's writing to them, a significant number of the people in Corinth don't like Paul and don't really consider him to be an apostle. So what he's saying is, I chose to limit my freedom. I took no money from you. And I think because he didn't want it to be a stumbling block. He didn't want them to think that he was in it for the money. You know, they could say, oh, we don't have to listen to him. He's just here for the money. Well, they couldn't say that about him because he didn't take any money from them. So he puts this out as an example of, see, the way I live my life is I think about the impact of my actions on other people. And even though I have the right to do something, if what I do would end up being hurtful to the other person, then I don't do it. And furthermore, he goes on to say that it's important to me to do this because it's not enough just for me to be a preacher of the gospel, to tell you what the gospel is and encourage you to have faith. I have to live out my faith as a believer myself. And it might be all very well for me to be preaching the truth to you, but if I'm not thinking about the impact of my actions on you and limiting my freedom out of love, then I'm not really thinking about the implications of my faith. And so I may be telling you to live as a believer, but I'm not living as a believer as I do this. And so he concludes then using this language about how he buffets his body to make it his slave, lest he should be disqualified in the end. What he's saying is, I submit myself to limitations, lest I should end up having lived in such a way that I was not living as a believer, even while I was telling you that you ought to be. So let me explain what I'm getting at here. If we look at 1 Corinthians in this way, I think we can start to see the problem with the argument that sees Paul as advocating a discipline of frugality or something like that. And I have two comments here. First of all, the author says that Paul was practicing the discipline of frugality when he refused payment from the Corinthians, but this is a misleading way to think about it. There's no evidence that Paul refused payment as a religious discipline. His motive was not that somehow poverty would be better for him spiritually. We know that, in fact, he didn't have that attitude. that there were others who financially supported him. He writes to the Philippians. He's very grateful to them for the financial support that he's giving them. He's glad to take it because it's an opportunity for them to be generous. And he thinks, this is great that you are thinking about me and giving me this money. This is great. And he talks about how he has learned to be content with little and with a lot. That he has learned there, you have to learn how to deal with not having much, but you also have to learn how to deal with having a lot. And he's saying, I've learned how to deal with both of those things. So in that, there's really no hint in what Paul's saying there that he sees somehow that it's better to not have any money and that that is a spiritual discipline that will make you stronger to do spiritual things later on. The reason he refused payment from the Corinthians was, if I took the money, it might be a stumbling block to you, and I don't want to be a stumbling block to you. Then, my second comment would be, when Paul says, I buffet my body, he is not talking about religious disciplines, he's talking about moral disciplines. That is, he's not saying, I impose religious disciplines on myself so that later I can have spiritual success. He's saying, rather, when the moral implications of my faith demand that I limit my freedoms for the sake of others, then I gladly do it. He's saying in this situation it was the right thing to do. He wasn't disciplining himself arbitrarily so that later on some good thing would happen. He's looking at this and saying, should I take the money? No, I shouldn't. So he didn't. He is talking about a kind of discipline. He's talking about limitations of what we eat and what we choose to do with our bodies. That's why he uses this buffet my body language. I submit myself to discipline. I submit myself to limitations. I do without things, like someone who's training for the games. But I'm doing it because it is the appropriate and right thing for someone who is seeking to inherit eternal life to live faithfully, and that requires at times limiting my freedoms and not doing everything that I might want to do. So Paul talks about how he limited his freedom to eat whatever he wanted when he was with the Jews. He no longer felt the obligation to eat kosher, but when he was with the Jews, he did eat kosher so that he wasn't a stumbling block to them. And he's telling the Corinthians, you guys, when it comes to eating this meat sacrificed to idols, you have the right to eat it, but that's not the whole question. The question is, should you, even though you have the right to eat it? And in order to answer that question, you have to ask yourself, what impact is my behavior having on other people? So I hope the distinction I'm trying to make is clear here. Yes, Paul is speaking of a discipline in the sense of he's limiting himself, but not because he's teaching that I need to submit to discipline so that I will exercise my spirituality and turn into a more spiritual person. I submit to disciplines because when it's the right thing to do, I should do what is the right thing. It seems to me, if we want to know about whether Paul finds religious disciplines adequate to produce spiritual maturity, we would do better to look at his argument in Colossians 2:20, where he says, if you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with the using, in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men. These are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. Now, in Colossians, he's talking not specifically about religious disciplines. He's talking about a legalistic mentality that commands that we abstain from various things. But his final comments there seem to me to speak very decisively to this issue of is treating the body severely the key to arriving at spiritual maturity? He says, self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, which are of no value against fleshly indulgence. I mean, it seems pretty clear that Paul doesn't see those as the road to victory over sin or anything like that, or else he would advocate it. He would say, boy, you guys better be doing this stuff because this is the way to get there. And what is of value of fleshly against fleshly indulgence? Well, in Colossians, I think he's painting a similar picture to what we've been talking about in this class. Spiritual maturity results as a work of the Spirit in opening our eyes to the truth of the gospel and strengthening our hearts to persevere in that truth. That's the bottom line. That's what it's about. So, I went over this stuff here just as an example of the kind of problem that I have in general with the line of argumentation that says there is a victory over sin and a level of spiritual success that you're not achieving yet, but you could if you would be fasting and rigorously, you know, going out and living in the desert and not having a lot of money and those kinds of things. That's just not what those passages are teaching, I would say. There's something serious being taught in those passages, but not that. Okay. A similar point related to the way we think about the Bible. I think you could say that I'm about to make an argument from silence, but I would like to argue that sometimes arguments from silence can be meaningful. You have to be careful about them, but there are some silences that are different than other silences, and I want to argue that this is a significant silence. Okay. The teaching of Jesus and the letters of his apostles are filled with exhortations to struggling Christians. Practically every letter in the New Testament is written to some church where there are all kinds of problems going on. I would argue that they never tell their audience that the way to solve their spiritual problems is to practice religious disciplines. I always see them doing the same thing. I mean, we could just start in Paul's letters and just run through them all. And I would argue that we're always seeing a similar sort of thing. When it comes to admonitions and exhortations to people, what should you do? They remind their readers of the truth about God's love, the truth about the eternal riches of the kingdom of God, the truth about their own need for mercy, and so forth. Then they tell their readers to believe that truth and live in the light of that truth. That's what the biblical admonitions are. This is what's true, remember? So, how should you live then, given the fact that that's true? So, that's what the apostles do when people are in the midst of spiritual struggles and are immature spiritually. That's the kind of advice they give them. I know that arguments from silence are tricky, and they can be gotten around. The author that I was mentioning earlier says, well, he acknowledges that Paul doesn't teach spiritual disciplines, but he argues that Paul didn't need to remind his readers of the importance of the disciplines because it was so obvious to him and everyone else. Well, I like my argument from silence better than his argument from silence, I think. Because, I mean, Paul is clearly telling them what he thinks they most need to know. They're having big problems, and he's telling them this is what needs to happen. So, it may be that they may have heard about spiritual disciplines before, but they certainly aren't having any effect in the situation. So, if that's the key to spirituality, this is the time for him to come in and tell them, this is what you need to do. But he doesn't. Okay. And then, yeah, we... Okay. Yeah, I can... This last point is one that deserves a lot of discussion, and I'm going to make it really briefly. But there is an implicit, or not so implicit sometimes, part of the argument that is made by the modern proponents of the spiritual disciplines. Basically, they picture Christianity as filled with Christians who are failing at spirituality. The reason that we're failing at spirituality is because we're not practicing the spiritual disciplines. And so their argument is, look around. We're looking at a bunch of spiritual losers. Why is it that we're looking at a bunch of spiritual losers? Because they're not fasting and so forth. If they were doing that, then they would find the spiritual success that Jesus found and Paul found and so on. So you'll find language in these authors that saying things like, Jesus has offered us rest for our souls, but we are not finding rest. Jesus has offered us an abundant life, but we are not finding life. Christians are supposed to be the salt of the earth, but we are not the salt of the earth, because look around, the world's in a mess, and if we were the salt of the earth, then the world wouldn't be in a mess. So if Christianity were working the way it is supposed to, then Christians would not be struggling with sin, non-believers would be streaming into our churches, and society would be transformed. And the fact that those things aren't happening is evidence that we're not practicing our spirituality right, and their solution to the problem is fast and live solitary in the desert and practice poverty and things like that. My problem, let's forget about the issue of spiritual disciplines as the solution. My problem is I don't agree with the diagnosis. I don't think that it is true that, do I believe that the world is in a mess? Yes, I believe that the world is in a mess. That's not a problem. But I believe that the Bible teaches and that it is true. I have no embarrassment in saying this, that I believe every believer, every child of God is a spiritual success. Every child of God has a faith that overcomes the world. Every child of God is salt and light in the world. Every child of God is taken through trials that test and mature our faith. Every child of God enters into the rest that Jesus promised. Every child of God receives abundant life. It's not that most of us are not getting it and the few of us who practice the spiritual disciplines are, but every believer inherits all of those things. The New Testament is not filled with exhortations for Christians to advance to a higher level of power and spiritual success. It is just filled with simple exhortations for us to persevere in following the gospel, believing it, and living in the light of it. The only distinction that I see the Bible making is between immature and mature. There are those who have not yet come to the place where their faith has kicked into their thinking. They're still thinking about the world the way they did before they were believers. And the Bible presents that God taking us through the testing of our faith and the trials of life and so on as those places where we start to have to come to terms with what the Bible is really talking about, what the gospel is. And in that process, then, it starts to sink into our thinking. We start to wrestle with it and actually make it our own. And that's a maturing process. And so there is that distinction. But that's the only one. And how do you move from immature to mature? Not by practicing spiritual disciplines, but by persevering in faith in the midst of the struggles of your life. So I guess what I'm saying then, in the end, basically, is I don't believe in the concept of spiritual disciplines as the key to a successful Christian life. What I believe in is living out my faith in the midst of real life. I don't believe, for example, that the Bible presents prayer as a discipline, a tool to increase my spirituality. As we've talked about before, prayer is a way of living out my faith. I pray because I believe God is there, because I have business to do with Him, because I am confused and I turn to Him for help, because I am grateful and I tell Him so, because I have nowhere else to turn. That's why I pray. Does spiritual growth come from prayer? Sure. If I am turning to God in the midst of the real life pressures in my life, then that turning to God is the right thing to do. And it is a spiritually mature thing to do. And persevering in turning to God in my life will be a sign and in fact, it will foster a spiritual maturity in my life. But I can't decide, well, you know, if praying two times helped me get mature, praying four times will get me twice as mature, and praying eight times will make me four times as mature. I mean, it's not like that. It's not a tool that causes maturity. It is a living out of my faith, which is the process of maturity. The same thing about, if we wanted to talk about meditation, as I was saying before, the biblical concept is very simple. God has revealed the truth in His Word, and I think about it. I think about my life. I think about what God is doing. I remind myself of what is true. I get away from the pressure of my life and I think about the things that are more important. The Bible talks about that kind of stuff a lot. But it doesn't advocate an emptying of the mind as a way to some sort of ecstatic mystical union with God or something. That's just not the way it pictures it. So, basically, what I object to is the idea that the disciplines such as fasting and solitude and so on are the means to arrive at spiritual maturity. There is a discipline that the Bible talks about, but the key discipline is the discipline that God exacts on us. The situations he puts us in where we have to deal with, is he good? Do I trust him? Do I believe in the promises of the kingdom? Is that what I want? And so on. So that I see my life and the situation that I'm in now in the light of something bigger. That's a discipline that God puts us through so that we can learn, so that we can actually come to understand what's important. Now, let me be clear here. I am not saying anything about any particular practice that anyone might engage in. If you decide you want to get up every morning and pray to God, that's great. I mean, I have nothing to say to that, like, oh no, you shouldn't be doing that. That's not what the Bible says. That's not what I mean. It might be a very wonderful thing in your life to do that. Some people have had that experience. Others have found it not so wonderful as they have tried to do that sort of thing. I'm not saying that you shouldn't fast. You say, well, I see Jesus fasting. I'm gonna fast and see where that gets. There may be indeed physical, emotional, spiritual benefits from doing something like that. My purpose is to set aside and think about what's important and focus my mind on the important things in life. I'm not here to say no, those things don't work. You don't want to do that. That's not what I'm saying. My concern is with the teaching that I see quite a bit out there, that somehow these are the biblically sanctioned techniques that will get you to spirituality. The biblically sanctioned techniques to become spiritually mature are persevere in faith. That's the biblically sanctioned technique to become spiritually mature. All of those things, and for different people they can play a different role. I'm not down on them in any way. But I do think it's important when I read Paul saying pray without ceasing that I understand that's not Paul saying get up at 6 o'clock every morning every day and pray. That's not what he means. It may be a good thing to do, but that's not what he's getting at. And that's the thing that I think is important for us to understand about the spiritual disciplines, is the idea that there is a technique to arrive at spirituality is a popular one out there. And there are many different versions of it, but this particular version, like all of them as far as I'm concerned, is not really biblical. It's not what the Bible's saying. The discipline that God takes us through is a theme that we see in the Bible a lot. In Hebrews, God's discipline is for the moment sorrowful, but afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Now there's a spiritual discipline that works. Afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. The problem is, this is not a discipline that I put myself through. It's a discipline that God takes me through. We saw the passage in James. Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. And let perseverance have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Here again, here is a discipline that has an effect. It works. There's no doubt that it works. But it's not in my hands. It's not a tool that I have been given. It's a tool in God's hands. And the assurance of such passages, and there are many more of them, is that God is the craftsman working on my life. God is the teacher, and I'm the student. And as I like to say, in God's schoolhouse, none of his students flunk. Every one of his students gets the lesson in the end. They understand what it's about in the end. So, understand what I'm saying. Don't go away from this going, oh, I used to think it was a good idea to read my Bible every day, but now that I've heard Ron, throw that out. I mean, that's not what I'm getting at. But at the same time, let's be clear about what the implications are of what we're doing, what the promises are that God has made, and what in the end is the bottom line. What am I really being called to? That's what I'm concerned about. Okay, well, I'm a little surprised. I must have really talked too fast because I had too much stuff to talk about and I got done early. So I apologize for that. We might want to play the tape back at a slower speed. Maybe everybody would understand what I'm saying better. But anyway, I'm done. So it's your opportunity if you have any questions. Come on. Yeah. We're going to give you the mic just so other people can hear it later on.
Okay. At the end there, you said something that reminded me of a friend who, when things are getting a little bit obviously difficult in her life, always reminds me that she needs to be reading her Bible more. And I always find that a little ironic. It sounds like it is a more of a prescription. Anyway, that's not even my question. I was just thinking out loud.
Okay, but Ashley, could you say it again? What is she saying when she's in a difficult
situation? Yeah, well, it seems to be that she says it a lot. And I've noticed that every time she says it is right after she said something that's going haywire.
Huh. And then she'll tell you that you should be reading it?
No,
Bible
she'll
more?
Tell me that she should
oh,
be
that she
reading
should.
It more.
Okay.
Right.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, she feels like things must have gone haywire because she wasn't in the Word.
Right. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Anyway, it was interesting that what you were saying reminded me of that. But the question I have, I'm not sure how it ties in specifically. It may be just a little bit off topic. But when you were talking about Paul doing what he did to avoid being a stumbling block, what I was thinking about is, for somebody like me, how do I distinguish between being a stumbling block and being somebody who is, in a sense, taking a stand for the gospel?
Right. That's a great question. And it's really important to make that kind of distinction. Maybe the example that always comes to my mind is I mentioned the eating the meat sacrifice to idols, which... And we see a similar issue in Romans 14, where it's a question of eating again, where there it's described as some eat only vegetables and others eat meat. And again, it's this situation where Paul is saying to the one who feels free to eat the meat to consider the impact that this behavior is having on this other person. But what is the impact that's happening there? What is he concerned with? As I would understand the situation, you have two people who are supposedly they are both claiming to be believers. They're looking to Jesus for forgiveness and so on. And the advice that Paul gives in Romans 14, it's not that one of those groups of people is saying, you can't be saved unless you don't eat meat, or something like that. It's a disagreement that they have about what's the right thing to do in the situation. What Paul's concern is, what you don't want to do is communicate to the person who's weaker in faith. He's saying, what you don't want to do is communicate to them that you think that it is appropriate to be casual about right and wrong. Don't worry, you know, just do it. It'll, you know, you want to eat the meat and we won't worry about whether it's right or not. I think that, I don't know if you've seen this sort of thing or not, but I have seen this a lot, I think, in group dynamics where there's a thing that happens in groups of Christians where people feel like, you know, you're in a group where this particular group of people doesn't have a problem with like going to R-rated movies or smoking or various activities that more fundamentalist parts of the church would look at and say, oh no, you can't do those things. You're not supposed to do those things. I have seen it happen, this kind of spiritual pride that can develop where you feel quite superior because you know that you have the freedom to do these things. And when you're with people who don't feel the freedom to do that, you kind of put this pressure on them to, are you going to be hung up or are you going to be cool like us? And I mean, there's this genuine social pressure that happens there where I don't want to not fit in. But the problem is that this person is still in the spot where they're not convinced that this is the right thing to do. But they do want to fit in and they want to be a part of things. So whereas these folks are doing it because they think there's nothing wrong with it, this person is now sort of falling into that behavior because they want to be a part of the group, but they feel guilty about doing it because they're not really convinced yet it's the right thing to do. And that's the thing that Paul's arguing against. You're making them violate their conscience. They don't think it's right, but you're putting pressure on them to join you in this. That's what you don't want to do, is you're pressuring them to do what they think is wrong. Okay? And that's not a good thing to do. You may be right that it's okay to eat the meat, but it's not right for them to violate their conscience, no matter what they think about what's right and wrong. Now, compare that to the issue in Galatians with the Judaizers, who were arguing you can't be saved unless you are circumcised and follow the law of Moses. In a lot of ways, the issues are very similar from my perspective. That is, the issues themselves. Over here, it's a question of eating regulations. Is it okay for you to eat this stuff or not? And over here, it's a question of circumcision. Should you be circumcised or not? But what's different in those two situations is, over here, they're urging circumcision not because they think that's the right thing to do. They're urging it because they're saying God only saves those who obey his law. And so Paul, in that situation, he is almost proud of his defiance of them. You know, they came in trying to put pressure to get Titus, a Greek, circumcised, and we didn't give in to them for a minute. You know, he said, no way are we going to let them pressure Titus into getting circumcised. So Paul, in Romans 14, is giving the example, the advice, hey, you guys, you know, just agree to disagree. Don't pass judgment on each other's opinions and that kind of stuff. And in Galatians, he's saying, let him be accursed for preaching a different gospel. So Paul draws the line over here and will not submit. He doesn't say, well, for the sake of going along, you know, we just did that so that we wouldn't be a stumbling block. He wants to be a stumbling block to unbelief. He wants someone who is legalistic to bump up against Paul's refusal to submit to that and go, what are you doing? I mean, that's a good thing for them to have to deal with that. But he's not pressuring them to violate their conscience. He's pressuring them to reconsider their self-righteousness. But in the other situation, I'm actually genuinely seducing someone into doing something that they don't think is right. And so the issue is different. Oh, no, that's me. Oh, yeah. I never get calls from anyone that I don't know who it is. So if I did, that wasn't anybody I know. So I know that was an ad or something like that. I've been getting a lot of those lately. Sorry, I should turn that off. Okay, so if you see what I'm saying, the issue of being stumbling block is not doing something that someone else disapproves of. Sometimes I need to do things that other people disapprove of. The idea of a stumbling block is causing someone else, I'm encouraging them to do something that's wrong. I'm encouraging them to sin. And that's what Paul's against. So that's a long answer, but it's that distinction. I think if I say what I'm about to do is going to be offensive to that person, that is not enough for me to know whether I should do it or not. Because sometimes I need to offend other people, and other times I shouldn't. I have to stop and think about what's at stake in this situation. Sometimes the right thing to do is to offend someone.
I was also thinking about Jesus confronting the Pharisees.
Yes.
And the dynamic going on there where, and maybe I don't understand your distinction between violating your conscience and being self-righteous or whatever exactly you said there. but was Jesus asking the Pharisees to violate their conscience?
No,
I don't think I understand that.
Okay, well, no, I would say it's the other way around. I mean, well, tell me, give me an example of Jesus dealing with the Pharisees. Maybe
I was thinking about I was thinking of when the lady with the perfume and the Pharisees said, "What are you doing?"
Mm-hmm. Right. Jesus did at many times did things that were offensive to the Pharisees, and he didn't apologize for it. I mean, what I would say is, he didn't think, "Oh." I mean, there are specific examples. The disciples come to him and say, "Did you know that the Pharisees were offended by what you just said?" And he didn't say, "Oh, I'm sorry. I should be more careful not to offend them." His response was basically, "Who cares? I don't care whether I offended them." And it comes down to the fact that they're offended because they are blind. They're offended because they want something other than the truth to be the truth. So they need to, I mean, either they're just going to blow me off, or else they're going to, in my resistance to what they're doing, it's going to make them stop and think, well, maybe what's going on here? You know, I need to find out what's happening. So Jesus, I think, would be an example like Paul in Galatians, where Paul is almost eager to offend the Judaizers. I will not submit to you. I don't care. I'm not going to limit my freedom. I'm going to flaunt my freedom. And I'm going to tell Titus, flaunt your freedom. Do not be circumcised. And if they're offended by it, well, they need to be. Because of it's their self-righteousness, ultimately, that has led them to this place. And that's the picture in Galatians, that it is that idea that somehow God accepts me because I've done such a good job, you know, done the right thing. So Jesus, I think, is another example of that. Jesus is a hard one to follow as a guide because he never does anything else. I mean, he offends everyone. Everyone he talks to. You know, I think about this sometimes. I'm sure I've said this before, but I think about this sometimes. Is there is something in me that wants to be... No. Quite the opposite. There's something in me that wants to, when I'm talking to someone, I want to find that way to say it so that they will not be offended, so that we can, you know, talk together and it doesn't become a problem. Jesus, in almost every situation, he says the most outrageous thing that you could say. I mean, he always is confrontive and sort of in your face about things in a way that doesn't strike me as that sort of... you know, meek and mild, I don't want to rock the boat kind of thing. I don't want to rock the boat kind of guy. I know that, I mean, here I am tonight saying, well, I don't agree with this person and I don't agree with this person, but I don't actually like that. I mean, I would much rather get up here and say, I just think everybody's great because I like everybody being happy with me. I would like it if the entire world loved me unconditionally. And they didn't even have to love me unconditionally because they agree with me about everything. I mean, that's what I want. But, you know, so Jesus as a model, it's hard to know how far to go. I mean, you know, you feel like if you were to follow Jesus as a model, that, you know, you'd go to get French fries at McDonald's and you know, they'd say, can I take your order? And you would say, I think it would be better if you were to consider the eternal state of your soul or something like that, you know. Why are we talking about French fries? And to which they might respond, but you're the guy who came up here for French fries. I mean, what do you want? But, I mean, you know what I mean? It's like you don't quite know how to... Is he a special case or what? But, so, for myself, what's helpful is we have those two pictures there. Paul... in Romans saying, I want you to not pass judgment on each other's opinions. And I want you to live in such a way that you're not being a stumbling block to the other guy. And in Galatians, he's saying, I'm passing judgment on your opinions, and I have no intention of submitting to what you want me to do. And those are both appropriate responses. And we have to at least try to understand what would lead to either one of those situations. And I think... Love is the key to both of them. It is not loving to put pressure on someone else to violate their conscience, for example. It is not loving to reinforce someone in a soul-destroying lie. So, you know, that's where... And then there could be other issues that I would face as well, but the question of whether I'm going to be offensive or not might very well depend on what do I think is the most loving thing. Maybe this person who has a real problem that is causing destruction in their life, maybe then the most loving thing to do is to confront them and risk offending them in what I say, but maybe that's the appropriate thing to do. So the offense or not offense is not the issue. It's what's loving. But like I say, that's a great question, and I think Paul is a good example of that stuff, because I think he sees clearly that distinction, and you can see him practicing both of those things. Bob? Yeah.
Would you comment on that passage that says, discipline yourselves for the purpose of godliness?
Yeah. Remind me where it is.
I was afraid you'd ask me that. I started to look it up, and I figured I could quote it because I could remember it, but I don't know where it is.
2 Timothy.
Before we look at it, okay. I'll make a comment about what I expect the kind of issue you might find there. The question is, what do we mean for the sake of godliness? Do I mean submit myself to religious practices so that later on I will be a more godly person? Or do I mean, in my pursuit of godliness, discipline myself? That is, as I see godliness taking me down a road that requires me to limit myself or to put myself in difficult situations, I should do that. So and the question is, which of those things would he be saying? Now, tell me where we are again. 1 Timothy 4:7. That's in the New Testament, right? Okay. In pointing out these things to the brethren, you will be a good servant of Christ Jesus, constantly nourished on the words of the faith and of the sound... Am I in the right place? 1 Timothy? Okay. And of the sound doctrine which you have been following, but have nothing to do with worldly fables fit only for old women. On the other hand, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness, for bodily discipline is only of little profit, but godliness is profitable for all things, since it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. So, notice that beforehand, these doctrines that he was talking about, men who have... forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and know the truth. For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with gratitude, for it is sanctified by means of the word of God and prayer. So I think the issue here is actually one of those, should I be practicing an ascetic discipline? And so what I think he's saying is there are worldly fables fit only for old women that would tell you you shouldn't get married, you shouldn't eat, you know, those sorts of things. Don't listen to that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. He's saying, I'm not saying that there aren't going to be times when you need to actually abstain from something. But I think the model of what he means would be that model in 1 Corinthians 9, where I'm recognizing I'm going to limit my freedom for the sake of some other greater good that I'm pursuing, or many other things that it might be like that. So I think here, he's making the distinction about the sorts of things we're saying, that doing without in and of itself is not profitable. It doesn't really get you anywhere. But there are times when godliness will lead you to, in the pursuit of godliness, you will do without, and that's good because, as he says, bodily discipline is only of little profit. It really doesn't do me a lot of good to do without. It may, not that it's no profit, But he's saying it's of little profit in comparison with, though, godliness. If I'm pursuing godliness, that's a very profitable thing to do. So if I don't eat meat because I think by abstaining from meat I'm going to make myself more spiritual, I'm listening to a worldly fable. But if I don't eat meat because I am concerned that if I eat the meat I cause you to stumble, I'm living faithfully and loving you and limiting myself in that regard. Now, the not eating meat didn't do me much good, but the lovingly pursuing your good was a great thing to pursue. And I think the distinction he's making. Although not necessarily talking about meat sacrificed to idols there, but that kind of thing.
I think some of the problem is how we view maturity, the pathway to maturity, and how, because we're in a physical world, we often view spiritual maturity as we do physical conditioning. So in order to, so do we have a handle, or are we in control of our maturity as we are in making ourselves physically fit?
Right.
What is maturity? What is the pathway to maturity? If it's obedience, then self-discipline is a huge factor in achieving that end. And spiritual disciplines, if you will, are valid means to that end, to achieving discipline.
Okay, I missed. You said if obedience...
What is maturity?
Right.
How are we to obtain maturity? And that is analogous to how we look at ourselves in the physical world and how we condition ourselves, how we keep ourselves in shape. And physical discipline is very much a very important aspect of caring for ourselves in the physical world.
Right.
And it seems like a very natural crossover when we start viewing ourselves as beings that are directed toward an end of maturity. You know, and the exhortations about be holy as the Lord is holy. So how does that all factor together is what's going on in my head. I'm not really...
Yeah, well, it's because I am saying that the analogy breaks down at a certain spot. The connection between discipline and the physical realm is there are aspects to my body and to my physical being that are affected by what I eat and whether I exercise and where I live and the air I breathe and all of that stuff. So I think about it in terms of there are these things that can affect me in various ways. And if I'm looking to be healthy, then I have to think about the things that are having that effect. The question is whether what it is that affects my spiritual health. And what I'm saying is I see the biblical picture as being my spiritual health is affected by my coming to embrace. I mean, in this class, I've been trying to paint this picture of the issues that we have to confront to become mature. It is coming to believe that God exists and that He is merciful and that He is good and that I need to seek Him. I need to find out why He made me and what He's about. I need to come to terms with to understand, relatively speaking, what is valuable, what are the things that are most worth pursuing, and all of that. That maturity is, spiritual maturity as the Bible presents it, what I'm saying in this class, is it is coming to understand better and living in the light of what is true. I'm gaining confidence in God. I'm seeing the value of mercy. I'm seeing the value, the fact that I need mercy, and all of those things are becoming clearer to me, and I'm living my life in the light of those things. That's what maturity is about. So that would indicate then the things that will have an effect on that are the kinds of processes that the Bible talks about, that in the midst of my life, when something is pushing on me in a certain way, I'm having to come to terms with someone has done something against me, and I'm having to wrestle with the question of what is the value of mercy? You know, am I willing to forgive them in this situation and so forth? Therefore, I'm saying the reason that Paul can say that bodily discipline is of relatively little profit is because I can't affect my spiritual health through those things. I can affect something. I can become a person who has more bodily self-control if I make myself, you know, if I regularly fast and those things. It's not that it won't have an effect on me, but it's not going to have an effect of making me trust God more or believe that I am a sinner more or believe that you are made in the image of God as I am. If I want to think about how can I affect my spiritual health, it's not through that kind of self-control. It is the kind of self-control that I exercise when I am facing the question, do I trust God in the midst of this difficult situation in my life or not? So there is an analogy. I think you're right. I want to have a positive effect on my spiritual state, but the only way I can do that is through exercising my will towards believing what God has said in the midst of those circumstances. That is what the spiritual exercise is. That's the way that comes about. Whatever value there may be in the other disciplines, they can't ultimately affect my spiritual health. And I think that's what Paul's saying. So that's how I would... So I don't disagree with that picture, but what it is that has the effect, I think, is the question. Here and then here. Oh, thanks.
Can God make us less selfish and more loving? Truly.
Can he?
And does he over time?
Yeah. Well, in this life, I think the answer... Anybody who knows me knows that what I'm going to say is yes and no. But I think the answer is yes and no. Because selfishness, in one sense, is, and that's at the heart of what it means to be a sinner. And I'm going to wrestle with that problem my whole life. But there is another aspect to selfishness, which is a kind of embracing selfishness as a way of life. And I think the maturing process that we're talking about is one where I have something in me that is talking back to that thing in me that wants to be selfish, that I feel that pull, but I have a different values and beliefs about what is going on, and that the maturing of my faith is those values and beliefs becoming a deeper and deeper part of the way I think about things. So... in a sense, there's a kind of a godly hypocrisy that happens in those situations where it's true that there is still something in me that's pulling me to be selfish, but I may act against it, believing that I am acting in the way that I think is right. I mean, this is what I want to be about. This is what I value. This is what I want my life to be like. So in that sense, maturity can lead to and will lead to a deepening of my moral fiber, you know, that I'm more prepared to look at what's right in situations and try to do it. But that's not a simple process, and some of us, I think each one of us, are made in such a way that some issues are harder for us than others. You know, some of us, someone can have a particular area of their life where they find it very difficult not to act selfishly. And the reason for that, it can be because they have still not really dealt with a set of beliefs that they have that, you know, I have to have this thing and I cannot let go of it, you know. And it's not that they're not a believer, but they just haven't gotten to the spot where they've, God has brought that out on the front burner to say, let's look at this and deal with this thing. And sometimes it takes a while for that to kind of come to the surface and deal with it. So there's no timetable, there's no, it ought to look like this after so many years or anything like that. But the fact that I have continued to believe this for and had to live it out in my life over this period of time will definitely have an effect on the way I interact with the world. It might be that you'll find me in that situation where I don't do very well, that my initial reaction will always be bad. But what people are noticing about me is that it didn't used to be true, but nowadays I come back later and say, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. You know, and they're going away saying, well, you know, that's something different. Now, it's not different. I mean, he acted just the way I expected him to act when this happened, but there's something else going on there. So that's the yes and no that I mean. If the question is, am I going to stop being evil, having that impulse toward evil in me, I see no evidence in the Bible or in life that happens. But that doesn't mean that I can't be morally transformed in significant ways in this fight against that thing in me, I think. So, Deanna?
Yeah, I really like your talk, and it brings up a lot of thoughts. I was just thinking that I think if Jesus went to McDonald's and ordered French fries, he'd probably just say it in the usual way and say thank you, usually.
Yeah, yeah.
But he did, I mean, what I'm thinking about is it seems he had the most mature and understanding and sensitivity to people's hardness of hearts or softness of heart toward God, and to what, when there was generally that hardness of heart in evidence, then he was going to push against that.
Yes.
And when there were people who were in their stumbling way seeking God.
Yes. I agree with you. Although I do want to just add into that that I think we could find a number of examples where in dealing with his disciples or those that clearly he thinks, he follows up Peter's confession that he's the Christ and says, you know, flesh and blood didn't tell you that. God told you that. And the next thing he says to him is, get thee behind me, Satan. You know, so even with guys that he thinks are okay, he's quite prepared to get in their face given the right circumstances. But I agree with what you're saying. Go ahead.
And then I could try out a little analogy of my own that I've kind of thought of lately about in our spiritual lives compared to our physical lives, more in the sense of as we're like with children or in growing physically, the process that we start we just find ourselves in the world and our bodies are growing as children. I was thinking of like comparing an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old. An 8-year-old is still trying to figure out things about themselves, what it's like to be a person, and they might say all these weird things or do things that the 12-year-old would look at with disdain and say, oh, they don't know anything. You know, they're just dumb kid. But then an adult or a parent looking on could just smile and say they both, you know, see how immature they both are, that the 12-year-old knows more just because they've been alive on the planet longer and are going farther. And I was thinking I could imagine a scene where like there are some bigger kids or older kids recognizing, I don't know, they could jump across a space that was a little risky to do, but they're big enough to do that. So they urge the younger kid to come along, but the younger kid doesn't, you know, is hesitant about that because then they have good reason to be because they know they might fall. But so the bigger kids would have this attitude, unless there was someone that was like really more mature, coming back to the younger kid and saying, I won't do that because, you know, I want to be with you. And, I mean, it could go the other way. There could be little kids that say, we should never do that. That's the rule. You should never jump across there. And then, you know, it could go all kinds of ways. But the adult would understand better, usually, or someone more mature would understand when they might push someone to do something or let them hold back.
So in your analogy, who corresponds to the parent?
That I'm still thinking about that, but I would think maybe a person who's, I don't know, like 90 years old or something, really
so
wise.
The mature Christian.
Maybe a mature
spiritually
Christian.
Spiritually mature, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if maybe that was God.
Well, I was thinking of that too, just because that's about as far as I can go as someone, as a person being older. Anyway, so I'm still working.
Yeah. No, I got you. That's good. Okay. We'll stop. Next week will be the last one.